speakers are Adi Stern, Weizmann Institute of Science, Josephson Control, Topological Superconductivity. Please go ahead.
Thank you.
You need the speaker. Do you have it?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Thank you. So like everyone, I'm grateful to the organizers for getting us here. My plan is to tell you about some works I've been involved in concerning Josephson control topological superconductivity. So first, let me tell you my plan. There's also the time that gets involved, but so I don't know how far I'll get. But the first work I'm going to tell you about was done, was led by Anna Kesselman, who is here in the audience, and Fal Kopienka, and involved some older guys from Weizmann and Harvard, myself, Erez Berg, Bert Halperin, and Amir Jacobi. Then there's a follow-up, which I'll tell you, which was done in collaboration with Arbel Chaim, who is a postdoc not far from here in Caltech. Then there's another work with Erez, another one with Erez and Setiawan Wenming, who is a postdoc in Chicago, and a collaboration with experimentalists from Copenhagen. And we're funded by various sources. And there are also related works, very relevant works from the Copenhagen group of Carsten Flensberg and from a Delft group of Achmerov. So here's my plan. First, I'd like to give you a short reminder to one-dimensional topological superconductivity and to the way it is realized in quantum wires. Then I'll go from a quantum one-dimensional wires sort of a half a dimension higher, meaning I will introduce a system that's inherently two-dimensional realizes a one-dimensional a topological superconductor. And this will be a planar Josephson junction. Then I'll relate the two systems by taking the two-dimensional system and narrowing it down to one dimension. Then I'll tell you about the effect of disorder, which turns out here to be uncharacteristically friendly. It helps rather than giving trouble. And last, if I get to it, I'll tell you about ideas, how to braid Majorana fermions in one-dimensional topological superconductors of the type I'm going to discuss. So that's the plan. So as I said, I'll start with an introduction or a background. And the background has two pieces to it. First is the idea of one-dimensional topological superconductivity in nanowires. And that's based on two very beautiful works at about the same time, one by Roman Luchin and Jay Sao. Jay is here, I think, somewhere, and another by and Shankar Dasama, and another one by Yuval Oreg, my colleague and collaborators. And what they were saying is the following, is that if you put a one-dimensional topological, a one-dimensional quantum wire with spin orbit coupling in the wire, and with a magnetic field applied to it that couples only in a Zeeman way, because it's a one-dimensional wire, and you put it on an S-wave superconductor, you are going to get a one-dimensional topological superconductor characterized by two Majorana modes at the two ends. But for that to happen, you need to have your chemical potential in a narrow range at which the Zeeman field gaps one pair of Fermi points, and the superconductor gets another pair of Fermi points. So you see here the Hamiltonian has spin orbit coupling and magnetic field, and that's how it looks without the superconductivity. And then the superconductivity gaps the remaining two Fermi points and give you the 1D topological superconductor. Now, out of this idea came a long series of experimental efforts with experimental results, which I will not get into, but I'll just mention again that you need to tune the chemical potential to be in this narrow range. And that's a non-trivial task because you need to gate something that couples strongly to a superconductor, and the superconductor tends to screen the gate. Now, the second part of the background I'd like to mention is that there's nowadays a very impressive technical advance in the capability of growing two-dimensional heterostructures that involve superconductors and semiconductors. And that's done in Copenhagen, at Harvard, NYU, and various other places. So what I'd like is now to combine the two things. So to take these two-dimensional systems and make them and construct one-dimensional topological superconductors out of that. And the system I'd like to introduce is the following. We're going to look at the 2D electron gas in which there's a strong spin orbit coupling and there's a parallel Zeeman field. And we're going to have two superconductors, not one, two superconductors on the 2DEG in such a way that the Josephson junction is formed. Now, when you do that, you introduce a new control knob into your system, which is the phase difference between the two superconductors. And that's going to be a major player in this game. So there will be one knob that's the phase difference between the two superconductors, another knob that is the magnetic field, the parallel magnetic field here. And towards the end, I'm going to introduce two more knobs, which are the Josephson current you can drive between the two superconductors and the magnetic flux you will get if you put a magnetic field perpendicular to the junction. But for the time being, it's only the phase difference and the parallel field. Now, what I'd like to tell you is that when you look at this system, you find two interesting features. One is that you find a rather robust topological phase with very little fine tuning and with no need to tune the chemical potential. Once you put the phase difference between the two superconductors to be close to pi. And the second thing I'd like to tell you about is that the system may tune itself into a topological phase. By first order phase transition that's quite different from the topological phase transitions we're used to. So let me expand a little bit on these two features. First, as I said, we're looking at this stage at two parameters, the phase difference between the two superconductors and the Zeeman field along the channel coming out of the parallel magnetic field. And what you see here is a phase diagram in which the sort of light green or whatever you call it is a topological phase, and the white is a trivial phase, and you see that the topological phase covers about half of the area. Now, and you see that if you put the phase difference to pi, at least in an ideal world, you get a topological phase almost everywhere. The real world is what you see with the dashed lines, and I'll comment a little bit about the difference between the ideal world and the real world, which I assume you are familiar with in many other contexts. So the crucial point, as I said, is there's very little dependence on the chemical potential. There are assumptions being made here, and one is that the spin orbit energy is much larger than the Zeeman energy, and the other one is that the superconductors are white. Now I'm going to relax this assumption and see what happens later on. So this is the robust topological phase. Now, the second feature I talked about is this first order phase transition, and here's where it comes from. So this is the same phase diagram you saw before, phase difference and parallel field. Now imagine that you don't tune the phase difference, you just let the system, you don't connect the system into a flux loop, you just let it find the phase difference that will minimize its energy. So what we find is that phase difference is close to zero for certain values of a parallel field, but for other values, it jumps and becomes close to pi. Now this region is topological, so the system tunes itself into the topological region if you just let it find the phase difference that will minimize its energy. Now we also look at the critical current as a function of this parallel field, and it turns out that together with these first order transitions, there is a suppression of the critical current. In fact, this suppression was observed. I'll tell you about experimental observations as we go along, but the first observation I'd like to comment on is this suppression of the critical current was observed. Here you see data from Delft, from Srijit Goswami's group, and here you see earlier data from Amir Jacobi's group. So here you see basically the critical current as a function of parallel field. Here it's more complicated, but look here, the BC equals zero, and and this color is more or less the critical current. So you see it's going down and then up again. Now, this behavior of the critical current was observed, but is it really the first order phase transition we're asking about? There's no direct evidence for that. So that was, I expand a little bit on what comes out of our analysis of this system. Now let me tell you in a few minutes how it comes out. So here's the two-dimensional electronic system with spin orbit coupling. Rushba spin orbit coupling leads to two Fermi surfaces that are concentric and circular. In fact, I think that Lonia is going to talk extensively about what happens to these Fermi surfaces when you violently play with them. I'm going to play with them gently. So when you put a parallel field, they move towards one another, and I'm going to assume that motion to be very small, because as we said, the Zeeman field is much smaller than the spin orbit coupling. Now you put in the two superconductors with a phase difference of phi. What happens? So the one-dimensional topological superconductivity is going to live here at the channel. And in order to diagnose it, we need to solve the energy spectrum in that channel. Now, this is basically a particle in a box problem. It's only that the box is infinite in one direction and finite in the other direction, and that the walls of the box are very cold and are superconducting. So we need to solve the particle in a box problem, including Andreev processes and not just normal reflections. Once we've done that, we have the tools to tell us whether the system is superconducting, whether the system is topological or trivial, and those tools were given to us by Kitaev. And what he's saying is that in order to distinguish topological from trivial, we need to look at what happens at kx equals zero. So this system is a station invariant in the x direction, and therefore we can solve for different values of the momentum. We need to solve for kx equals zero, and this will tell us topological versus trivial. If we want to get other features like energy gap and temperature dependence and stuff, we need to solve for all values of kx. And as you probably realize, this is easier than this. So now, once we solve for kx equals zero, what Kitaev's criterion tells us is we need to look at the fermion parity at kx equals zero, which changes whenever you have a single gap closing at that value of the momentum. So we are looking at single gap closings at kx equals zero. So we need to solve the problem, the BDG equation, Bogdanov-Dejean equations at kx equals zero. And, you know, it's a particle in a box, as you can imagine, that the Bose-Sommerfeld condition that will tell us the spectrum. The Bose-Sommerfeld condition, as always, has a integer number of 2 pi's on one side of the equation and a bunch of phases on the other side. So let me tell you something about those phases. We have two phases which are accumulated as you move. They are the Zeeman phase, just the Zeeman energy multiplied by the time it takes you to go back and forth, and the kinetic phase. And then we have two phases that are accumulated when you are reflected. One is the phase difference between the two superconductors, and the other one is it comes out of the need to have continuity of the wave functions. So we need to solve this and find when is the energy zero. It's easiest to solve it when W is small, because then we can neglect this, and we find that the spectrum is delta multiplied by the cosine of half of the phase difference plus or minus the Zeeman phase that you accumulate due to the Zeeman field. So that's how it looks in the case where there is no Zeeman field. But when there is no Zeeman field, each of these lines is doubly degenerate, and this point is a double gap closing point. In contrast, once we put the Zeeman field and we have a non-zero value here, this plus minus separates the two, the closing point into two, and now we have one closing point here and one closing point here, meaning in between the system becomes topological. And this is what you see here. At zero Zeeman field, there's this double closing point, which takes you from trivial to trivial, but when you turn the magnetic field on, you have a range where the system is topological. Where is the chemical potential in all of this? Only in the Fermi velocity here, which is which depends on chemical potential, but it's a rather weak dependence. Now, this was all a solution for an infinite system or a system with periodic boundary conditions. Real life are finite systems, and you want to see the marijuanas. To solve for a finite system, you need to solve numerically, and that's what's done here. And you see the local density of states as a function of energy and phase difference in the bulk and at the edge, and you see the appearance of a zero mode at the system's end, close to phi equals pi. So that was our first theoretical work. As I said, if you have any questions that I don't know to answer, Anna will happily answer. That was followed by three experimental works. This one by Charlie Marcos' group in Copenhagen. Following one by same time, one by Amir Jacobi's group at Harvard, and the third one by Goswami's group at Delft. The first two, what they do is they have a Josephson junction, and they also have a tunnel contact to measure the local density of states at the end of the junction. The third one doesn't have that. And they see zero bias peaks. You see examples here and here. None of them is as big and pronounced as we would like them to be, but it's a good start. Now, we collaborated with the experimental group in Copenhagen, and at some point, looking at their samples, we realized that the superconductors in their samples, at least in the first round of experiments, were pretty narrow, were narrower than the coherence length, the superconducting coherence length, which means that it's these superconductors, instead of extending all the way to infinity, as our theoretical work suggested, the experimental work did not have enough superconductivity to go all the way to infinity, and this was in fact quite narrow. So we asked ourselves, what difference does it make? After all, if you narrow this down enough, you are back into the one-dimensional limit. So there should be a way to relate between the two-dimensional limit and the two-dimensional system and the one-dimensional limit. And it may be that the easiest way to think about it is not to think about this being narrow, but to think about the coherence length being very large, namely to think about delta as being very small. So let's think about the superconductivity as very weak. So now, and this as being finite. So we have a one-dimensional quantum wire, or quasi-one-dimensional quantum wire, with many, many subbands, many, many channels, many, many transverse channels. Now, having delta small means that each channel couples only to the same channel at each state at the plus k and particular channel couples only to minus k at the same channel. So the system decouples into many, many copies of topology of 1D superconductivity. And each one of the channels that you get may be either topological or trivial. In fact, in this situation, what happens is that for each channel, you have half of the superconducting coupling has a phase difference of phi over 2, half of it has a phase difference of minus phi over 2, and the combined two halves just average. So you get a superconducting coupling within each channel of delta cosine phi over 2. And when that coupling is weak, which is when phi is of the order of pi, this is where you get superconductivity. So the phase diagram, which was built before of this diamonds that I showed you, now breaks into a more complicated structure in which each subband may be either topological or trivial. The combined classification is not a Z2 classification, but rather at least to in that approximation and assuming the right-left symmetry between the two sides. There's an effective BD1 symmetry that makes the classification Z rather than Z2. So the phase diagram breaks into regions in which the number of Majorana modes at the ends can be any integer number, and the regions where we had before trivial superconductors will now have an even number of Majoranas. The regions where we have a topological superconductor will now have an odd number of Majoranas. That happens also in wires, and Jay and collaborators found that out before. Now, what I'd like to tell you now is what happens with this order. And as I said earlier on, this is a rare situation where this order in some sense helps. So let me explain in what sense it helps. So let's say we are somewhere, this is again the phase difference, Zeeman field, and this is the diamond I showed you before. Let's now think of a situation where we are in the topological diamond. We are in the topological regime, and we have a finite system, so it has two Majoranas at the two ends. And now let's ask, how does disorder affect the localization of these Majoranas? So the two Majoranas at the two ends are localized. We want them to be as localized as we can, because that will make the ground state degeneracy that they impose better protected. So we'd like them to be as localized as possible. And now we are going to look at how, what is the localization length as a function of disorder. And the first way to look at it is just numerically. And this is what Arbel Chaim did. So what's plotted here is the localization length normalized to the clean localization length as a function of disorder. Okay? Now, and that's plotted for 4 points inside the topological diamond. And what you see happening, it happens everywhere, including the red one, which is hard to see here. What you see that at first the localization length goes down. It's because of the normalization, it's 1 for the clean point. And then what you see that the localization length goes down, and then it comes up again. So at least at first, at least weak disorder makes the Majoranas more localized. And that's the friendly effect. What I'd like is now to explain this, and this explanation will have two parts. First, I'd like to identify who is responsible for the localization length, who determines the localization length, and second, why this order talks nicely to whoever is responsible for the localization. So first, the first step in understanding what determines the localization length is looking at the excitation spectrum as a function of kx. So remember, I told you all these Bose-Sommerfeld stories about the localization length at about the spectrum at kx equals zero. Now this is the spectrum for all kx's calculated numerically. And what you see is that there are two points where the gap is smaller than everywhere else, or 4 points here, but they're related by plus minus k. So 4 points where the localization length is smallest. Now, those points are the point that determine how, it's the smallest gap that determines how localized the Majorana states are. So it's the large k x gap that makes, that determines it. And we need to understand how the disorder affects this this gap. And what I'm going to argue is that it makes this gap larger. So in order to understand this, the way we think about it is we think about, we translate this to a system, to a problem where we have several channels, several one-dimensional channels, and we couple them with superconductors. We couple them with superconductors and with disorder. And we ask ourselves, how does disorder affect the local, the coherence length, or basically the superconducting coupling between each pair of one-dimensional channels. And now we do that perturbatively to second order in the disorder. And what we find is that for each channel M, the effective superconducting gap out coming out of disorder is the bare one, the one that, the clean one, plus a perturbative expression, which I'm going to expand on, but first let me write it here in red. So it's the clean one plus a, so this is the superconducting gap for channel M will be the clean one plus a sum over all other channels. The scattering rate into the from the channel M to the channel N multiplied by e to the I, the argument of the superconducting coupling in the channel you scatter to. So you start, so you look at the superconducting coupling in the channel M, and what happens to it is that it gets affected by the other channels, and this effect requires you to be scattered to the other channel. But once you're scattered, what makes the difference is what's the relative phase of the superconducting order parameter in the channel, the relative phase between the channel you were scattered into and the channel you were scattered from, and this is this phase difference. And you see, if this is, if there's a pi here, there's a minus sign, and the superconducting gap shrinks by disorder. If there's a plus here, it goes up. Both possibilities are open, and we need to understand what's the phase difference. And we'll understand that by looking at two particular cases. The first case is if you have just a single channel. So this is the Kitaev wire, just a P-wave superconductor, single channel, and disorder can scatter you only to your pairing partner. But now, what's going to be the phase of the channel you are being scattered to? That's determined by the, you know, fermion anti-commutation relation. So delta of minus m, because of the anti-commutation of these two, delta of minus m is always minus delta m. So this phase difference is always pi, which means if you are scattered into your pairing partner, you that reduces the gap, which means a disorder for this type of Kitaev wire will shrink the gap and will delocalize the Majorana modes and will weaken. Will weaken the localization of the Majorana modes. I'll just finish this argument. So it's a completely different situation for an S-wave superconductor, because there you cannot be scattered into your pairing partner, because your pairing partner has an opposite spin compared to the one you have. So there's no scattering into the pairing partner, and this negative phase difference doesn't apply. And in fact, if you look at it more closely, you find that disorder in this case enhances localization. Now, what's our problem? Is it like the Kitaev wire or like the S-wave superconductor? It turns out it depends what's the momentum. Large momentum has the spin being frozen, so you cannot be scattered from plus K to minus K, because spin orbit coupling makes the spin of plus K exactly opposite to the spin of minus K. So at large K, there is no scattering between pairing partners, and therefore there is no reduction of the superconducting gap. At small K, this doesn't exist, and you have a reduction of the gap. So what disorder does, it increases the gap here and decreases the gap at Kx equals zero. At some point, they equalize, and that's where the localization length is minimal. That's where the most friendly effect of disorder is expressed. So that's what I want to say about disorder. Now, I do want to say also how you braid marijuanas at the ends of this modes, but I can tell you this is a pretty clear sign you get. So I'll just flash the geometry looks like that, and if you play around with a perpendicular magnetic field and driving Josephson current across these three junctions, these are basically three Josephson junctions of the type I talked about. If you play with the currents and perpendicular field and use ideas developed on the other side of the road at station Q in this work of Karzig and collaborators, you can braid marijuana fermions in this setting. And you're welcome to ask me later. So just to summarize, what I told you, that the relative phase is a user-friendly parameter to use on the way to topological superconductivity. I told you that there's a first-order phase transition where the system self-tunes itself into the topological regime. I tell you that when the superconductors are narrow, it basically becomes a multi-mode wire. And I told you that disorder is good for you, and I didn't tell you about a scheme for marijuana braiding. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. Questions, please. There's still time left.
If one forgot for a while about topological superconductivity, you have SNS junction.
Absolutely.
And in SNS junction, it is known that there is non-sinusoidal relation between current and phase difference. It also amplitude in this relation can depend on width of the normal layer. Do you know this expression for your case, and what is the difference with usual?
Yeah, so what happens is, you know, let's look at limits. If you take W to be very, very large, instead of...
normal quantity is 1 over
A. Okay. So what you see here, there are modes. You see, this is the spectrum as a function of K, and this is the delta of the superconductors. So this is the continuum. Above delta, it's the continuum. Here you have some modes. I think here you have three modes which are confined to the interface. If you make W larger, there will be more and more and more of those. And we have some understanding of the phase difference of the spectrum and so on. We can discuss this with more details. But that's what's going to happen. Now, if you make delta W very, very small, then you will be left with one mode, and it's mostly will be at energy delta, except when the phase difference gets close to pi, and then it will go down like I showed.
ask about outcome, final relation between current and phase difference.
So I don't have an analytical expression, but we have a you know, a plot I can show you.
Plot.
Yeah, we don't have an analytical. Excuse me.
Sinusoidal.
No, of course not. Of course not. No, it's an SNS junction. Of course not.
The question is about this disorder help localization of marijuana zero mole. Do you know what's the condition for the optimal disorder that give you the smallest localization length?
What's the smallest?
Yeah, what's the condition to have this smallest localization length?
So it's a 1 over tau comparable to delta. Yes. Yes. Okay. Then you know the numerics is numerics. It's not confined to being perturbative, but that's what comes out of the perturbative calculation. Yes.
Regarding this zero byte transition, this is actually seen also in regular SNS junctions without. In the disordered case as well. So I guess the first or the phase transition that you show is actually not a topological transition as such, but it's just the usual zero pi transition. But of course, then in your case, it just happens to go to the topological regime.
Exactly.
But my question actually is that if you extend this W a bit further, you should also get beyond this Andrea bound state. You should also get these continuum states. The continuum states, that which are rho delta. And they usually also affect the current phase relation. So can you comment on their effect?
So if you, as I said, actually, it's here. As I said, if you make W large, you'll get more and more sub-bands here,
yeah, but
right?
Above
delta, you have a continuum. How does it affect the current?
Yeah, it also affects current.
Yes, it affects, but I don't remember expressions by heart. I don't know, Anna, maybe you do. Yeah, we have the expressions. I don't remember, you know, the from bound Andreev states. Yeah,
have some small dependence periodic into pi, regardless of the size of the topological.
That's right, yes.
So very nice talk. So with the swift of superconductor, yeah? So I think that because you were discussing about that, then you can more or less express it as some proximity-induced wire with many modes. But isn't it also that the finite width of a superconductor gives you a lot normal reflection and can actually shift the phase diagram or change some of the things over there?
Yes. So here is it's complicated. Yes, number one, there will be normal reflection from here if this is not larger than the coherence length. So you are not going to get perfect reflection, and therefore you're not going to get a perfect diamond. So indeed, if you look at the Z2 classification of class D, this is the line you see here. This is the line that replaces the diamond. It doesn't touch zero at phase difference equals pi. So initially we thought, okay, no marijuana is close to pi. But then we understood that if there is a symmetry between right and left, you will get pairs of marijuanas on this side. So there will be some topological aspect to it, which will survive even this normal reflection.
I have a question with respect to your multi-channel case.
Mm-hmm.
Would you get from each topological channel then a pair of Majoranas?
Yes.
How would you see that in an experiment, that you, by changing the width of your channel, changing the number of Majoranas?
Okay, you know, first question is, how would you recognize unequivocally a single marijuana, and then we'll worry about what would be nice to have is a way to split, to break this BD1 symmetry. Now, I would say the following. You know, everything I talked about was a magnetic field parallel to the junction. If you rotate it a little bit, not a perpendicular, still within the plane, but not along the channel, you break this symmetry and you will gap the marijuanas here. So that would be a way. You will introduce a gap by rotating the magnetic field.
Other questions? So indeed, there was no time for the most exciting part of your talk. there's no time for the theory, but how far are the experimentalists? Are they in a position to check what you are predicting?
So as I said, there are observations now of zero bias peaks, and the first thing you'd like to see, if you want to do all this braiding thing, is you want to be able to move the marijuana mode from here inside by changing a perpendicular magnetic field. So this is this is not braiding. This is a reasonably straightforward experiment. You turn on a perpendicular field, you look at the zero bias peak, and you want to see it disappearing. And that's an experiment that the Copenhagen people are doing now. But I don't know what they're seeing yet. But this is something we discussed a couple of weeks ago. But this is step one out of about 100 to get to braiding. And this is no easy task.
So you have still, then there are no questions? Oh, yeah.
About disorder. So in your definition of enhanced gap, you look at average quantities, right? So, but now my understanding was that you maybe not suppress gap, but you cannot actually enhance gap. You may be depleting density of states for quasi-particle states above the gap. But so I didn't understand actually what do you mean by gap when you are showing your perturbative expressions.
So okay, it's a good question because it's clearly some kind of a self-consistent bone or second-order perturbation. It's second-order perturbation theory. In real life, of course, once you have disorder, there are no gaps. All gaps close.
Right.
But
so what they're talking about.
what we're aiming at is an explanation of this. Now, this is localization. So this numerical calculation, you calculate the localization length of the
right.
of the marijuana. So this is localization. Now, you can ask whether, in the limit of an infinite junction, and maybe all the second order perturbation theory will not work, and there will be some localization issues inside the bulk of the junction, all this, they seem not to be relevant for this observation. This analysis explains this quite nicely.
Okay.
So maybe a quick follow-up to that. What did the spectrum look like in some of these cases? Like, were there a lot of low-lying states? Because that could be a problem at finite temperature.
I don't know what the spectrum looks like. We didn't calculate it. My guess is there will be many low-lying states. As long as they don't reach the ends, I think you can live with them. Because they don't touch. As long as you have two zero modes which are separated from anything else, you're fine. Even at finite, as long as they are decoupled, if they are decoupled from anything else, then if you put in, eventually, yes.
So this is more a comment on that
question. We looked at the spectrum in the presence of disorder and these Majorana modes, and you don't actually generate states within the gap if you do the problem self-consistently. We can discuss it. But yeah,
okay.
The Majorana modes are seem to be protected even with disorder, non-magnetic disorder.
Yeah, so that's more optimistic than my answer. And since you mentioned the magnetic and non-magnetic disorder, if you put in this calculation, we did a calculation with magnetic disorder, and all this goes away. So disorder is detrimental when you put in magnetic disorder.
Okay, kudos for all the speakers of this morning and for the lively discussion.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.